I know my heart is a ghost town.
Hey, Northridge, how are you guys? Good to see you. My name's Pete, and I'm so glad to be here with you guys. Pastor Brad had asked me some time ago if I would be willing to come up some this fall and teach, and I was like, fall, yes, I love fall. Fall in Nashville, where I live, is when it stops hitting 90 and it goes to about 75. That's not 75 out there. That's not fall. That's winter. That's deep winter out there. I didn't even bring a coat. I was like, what is going on? This is crazy. But I really am just so excited to be here and be with you guys. How many of you woke up this morning and the first thing you thanked Jesus for was Purdue? Yeah. I knew when I saw that gal, like, they're going to be so happy about that. Like, they are really going to love that. So we're starting a new series today, and it's called Ghost Town. And this series is actually today is not so, I mean, it is a message, it's a sermon, but it's almost like a setup, all right, to where we're going to go the next couple weeks and what we're going to talk about, this idea of how our hearts sometimes can feel like a ghost town. And then what happens to us when we try to take that emptiness and we try to fill it with different things. Now, ghost towns in and of themselves are pretty interesting, and this series title like just fits the kind of time of year that it is anyway, but I did some research this week on ghost towns, and the official definition, by the way, of a ghost town is it's a town for which the reason for being no longer exists. All right, so think about that, a town where the reason for being no longer exists. And there's ghost towns all around the U.S. In fact, I did some research. In Michigan, there are 221 official ghost towns. Towns for which, like, the reason for being just no longer exists. Some of them, really, there's very little left of it to be able to even tell that it was once a town. But others of them are quite beautiful. I got some pictures for you. This first ghost town, this is Fayette, Michigan. I'll show you some pictures from there. I don't know if you've, have you ever heard of Fayette, Michigan? Okay, a couple of you, probably not many of you unless you're like a ghost because it's a ghost town. So that house is still there. It's beautiful. You can go visit it. There's another one that kind of shows you the overall like village there, the little town. I think that's actually a state park now. They've turned it into a state park and restored a lot of that. But again, it's a town that at one time was vibrant, at one time had vision, at one time had industry. In fact, that particular town was an iron operation. And then when the operation, you know, ceased to be, everybody kind of moved out. It just vacated. It became empty. It's nothing but a shell. It looks pretty on the outside, but there's no life there. Here's another one. This is Glen Haven, Michigan. I think this one's really pretty. And you can go and you can visit that. Here's another shot of a home there. But it's empty, right? It's just a shell. And that's kind of the nature of a ghost town. Now, some ghost towns are vast. They're like massive. And ghost towns pop up for different reasons. Sometimes a ghost town develops a very large ghost town just because people who lived there thought, why does anybody live here? Why would anybody live here? And then they all just moved away. I'll show you one last picture of a ghost town. sorry. Sorry, gosh. I know it's a cheap laugh, but it works every time with you guys. And so I just have to go for it. But he said, we're easy. I was like, yeah. I have family. Both my parents were born in Ohio, so all my family's in Ohio. So I they don't even talk to me anymore because I've completely sold out to try to get your approval. So. But you get the idea of the ghost town, right? It's on the outward appearance. It's there. It exists. In fact, many of them still look beautiful. But there's no life there. There's no vision there. There's nothing going on there anymore. The purpose for which that town existed no longer exists. Now, Jesus one time addressed this idea that our bodies can almost be like a ghost town. And this is what he said, Matthew chapter 23. He said, you're hopeless, you religion scholars and Pharisees, frauds. You're like manicured grave plots. grass clipped and the flowers bright, but 6 feet down, it's nothing but rotting bones and worm-eaten flesh. People look at you and think that you're saints, but beneath the skin, you're total frauds. That's strong words. But what Jesus is doing is setting up this idea, this concept of beneath the skin. What's he saying? He's saying that, hey, what's going on beneath the skin? What's going on in your heart? What's going on in what some people would call the soul is what is actually most important about you. It's not the shell. It's not the external. It's what's going on inside. What's going on inside that soul where your thoughts and your feelings and your judgments and your hopes and your fears and your beliefs and all that is being formed. And I think in a lot of cases, we have a lot of false beliefs about our inner lives, about our souls, about our inner beings. The kind of false beliefs that can paralyze you in hopelessness. It can fill you with false guilt and keep you from joyful living. It can limit your ability to develop authentic relationships. And part of God's plan from the very beginning is that you and I would pay close attention to what's going on the inside, that we'd pay close attention to this whole inner being. But my fear is that what's happened in a lot of circles of Christianity is that our focus a lot of times is on external. We make a lot of our judgments based on the external, on what we see on the outside, without paying a whole lot of attention to what's going on the inside. In other words, in a lot of circles of Christianity, our focus is on sin management. Outside of Christianity, they call that behavioral modification. All right, and that's where a lot of our focus is. But when you read through the Bible, Jesus did not come so he could edit your behavior. Jesus came so he could transform or change our hearts. That's what he was about. And so sure, in the church, we can tell you, hey, don't be greedy. We can tell you, hey, don't be self-preoccupied. We can say, don't hold on to your bitterness. We can say, don't be sexually promiscuous. We can say, whatever you do, don't be power hungry. We can tell you all the things like, don't do this, don't do that. But what if we stepped back? And this is the goal of this series. What if we stepped back and we said, hey, what is it that's actually going on inside of your heart that would make you want any of those things in the first place? What's going on inside of me? What's going on inside of you that makes us chase after things that actually don't satisfy us? Now, let me set this up by kind of going to the Old Testament. And the Old Testament, in its simplest form, is just a story, right? It's a story about a group of people, the Israelites, and their journey through life to what it would look like for them to trust and love a God that they can't even see. A faithful God, but they can't see this God. And so how do they love this God? How do they trust this God that they can't see? And they're on this journey where God's kind of revealing himself to them. The Israelites spent hundreds of years in slavery, and then God frees them through Moses, right? And then one of the very first things that happens for the Israelites once they're free is that God gives them the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments, we often think about them as some law that nobody could ever like completely live up to, but the Ten Commandments are actually this gift that God gives the Israelites. And Moses comes down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments. And you remember the very first command? The very first command, don't have any other gods before me, right? You shall have no other gods before me. And I always thought, that's interesting. Like the very first commandment, like the very first law in the most famous moral code in the history of the world is God saying to his people, hey, don't have any gods before me. Now, why is that first? I don't know exactly, but I think I have an idea. And I think my idea is, you think about the Israelites, they've been slaves for over 400 years. Slavery is fundamentally inhumane, right? Being owned and treated as a piece of property robs people of dignity. It robs them of knowing what it is to feel human. And this has deeply affected the Israelites, right? This has affected the Israelites in how they view themselves. It affects the Israelites from how they view the very world around them. And so the very first thing that God does here with the Ten Commandments is he's starting this kind of long and very gentle process of reminding the Israelites what it's like to be human, what it's like to flourish as a human again. And so he says, have no other gods before me, because he knows that their humanity is directly linked to their liberation, which was a gift from him. So he says, don't have any other gods before me, because he knows if they forget about God, they might forget about their story. If they forget about their story, they might forget about what it was like to have been enslaved. If they forget what it was like to be enslaved, they might be tempted into a new form of slavery. And so part of what the Ten Commandments were there, and a huge part of why God says, don't have any other gods before me, was not to slap some kind of law on them that would limit them. It was about freedom. He's like, I want you to experience freedom. I want you to flourish as a human being. And part of flourishing is that you'll have no other gods before me, because the moment that you like have another God before me, you're instantly enslaved to that God. And so when we talk about this idea of idolatry in our culture, it's kind of a confusing topic, because if I talk to you about what's an idol, you immediately think of like a statue or something like that. And even if you don't think about a statue, if I were to say, well, what's it mean to have another God above our God? And you'd be like, well, I guess if something were more important to me than God, that would kind of be an idol. And you'd be technically correct. The problem with that is if you and I go out to lunch today and I just ask you, hey, is anything more important to you than God? Your response, probably 9 out of 10 of you, you're going to say, oh, no. No way, Pastor, absolutely not. God's like the most important thing in life. Nothing's more important than God. And then you begin to think that this isn't an issue for you. But here's the working definition of idolatry we'll use the next couple weeks. Idolatry is anything that you seek to give you what only God can give you. So anytime you seek from someone or something, something that only God can give you, that thing becomes an idol. And I'm so interested in this topic. I'm so interested in exploring this with you guys the next couple weeks, because this series isn't about sin. This is about the sin beneath the sin. This is about what tends to be kind of fundamentally broken often in the human heart. And I think this is so important, because God knew something about me, and God knows something about you, and God knew that there would often be an inner emptiness inside of us. God knew there would be times that, like, we feel like a ghost town, right? We feel this emptiness. We feel this longing for purpose and beauty and significance and forgiveness. We feel those longings. We feel that emptiness. And there's a temptation that God knew we would have. And the temptation sometimes for me is to think, wow, you know, if I could make a little more money, then maybe I'd be happier. Right? God knew that there'd be a temptation inside of me and maybe inside of you to start to think, oh, wow, you know what? If I could move up one more position at work, if I could get that new title, if I could move into that corner office, oh, yeah, then I'd have value. Like if I could have like the perfect family and the perfect like Pinterest looking home, like then, right, then I'd have value. God knew that we'd be tempted, some of us, to think, oh, if I could get that certain person to love me, then I would have security. Or be tempted to think, oh, if I could get more likes on this picture on Instagram, if I could get more people to follow me on Facebook, then I'd be satisfied. You see, we live in a culture where the problem is not the making of idols or external idolatry. In our culture, it's internal idolatry. Ezekiel 14 says this, these men have set up idols in their hearts. And what God is saying is it's possible for the human heart to take good things, and this is what makes this topic kind of confusing. It's possible for the heart to take really good things, things like a successful career, things like love, things like material possessions, even family. It's possible for the heart to take those good things and twist it just a little bit to start to actually think that those good things can somehow give us something that only God can give us. And the story of humanity, I don't have to tell you this, the story of humanity is a story of us spending our lives chasing after things that do not satisfy us, have never satisfied us, and never have any hope of satisfying us, but we chase after them anyway. And the lie that so many of us have bought into is that more of what doesn't satisfy us will probably satisfy us. Right? Haven't you bought into that lie before? You have this, right? It might be some amount of money, or this for you might be a certain title, right? Or this for you might be a home. Who knows? It can be a lot of different things. And you think even though this hasn't brought you happiness, more of that might work. And so we kind of fall into that cycle thinking, I need more of this. C.S. Lewis said it this way. He said, most people, if they'd really learned to look into their own hearts, would know and they would know acutely that they want something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world to offer to give it to you, but they never quite keep their promise. C.S. Lewis saying, the world's full of empty promises. The psalmist said it like this in Psalm 63. He said, O God, you are my God, and earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and a weary land where there is no water. The psalmist kind of describes this world that we live in, this earth that we live on, as this dry and this weary land. Like you kind of go through life and it feels dry and you become weary and you have this thirst. And if you don't seek after God to quench that thirst, you're going to seek after something to quench that thirst. And for some of you, it's been success. For others of you, it's been approval. For some of you, it's been sex. For some of you, it's been money, right? It's something that you're chasing after to quench the thirst. But the reality is all of those things, it's like trying to quench your thirst with sand, right? How much sand will finally quench your thirst? And the answer would be never enough, right? It just compounds the thirst. And so we're left in this world just thirsty, wanting, longing, because we've established all these idols that we think can give us something that only God can give us. So part of what I want us to do as we kind of start this journey together is just to be a little vulnerable with ourselves, to be honest with ourselves and say, okay, what are some of the things in my life that I could be tempted to look to give me something that only God can give me? So if you have your outline that you got when you came in, it's inside of your program, will you pull that out? And I'm going to do a little thing. We're going to call it the idol test, okay? Aren't you so glad you got up and came to church for that? Sounds so much fun. But the idol test is, I'm just going to run through a couple questions with you to help you kind of begin to see where you might have a tendency to look to something to give you something only God can give you, all right? Let me run through the five I listed. And understand on this idol test, there are hundreds of different things that we can turn into idols in our life. Hundreds of them. Like, so I only put kind of five broad ones on there. We could add more, we could add sports, but then things get real personal. And so we're just gonna keep it to these five right here, right? So let me run through the categories and then I'll ask you some questions. The first one's money. That one's kind of obvious. Money always wants to be more than money in our life, right? It always wants to hold a different position. So there's money. The second one's success. You could put work next to that if you wanted to, but when it comes to success, work, whether that's in the home or in an office building or whatever, man, people will trash their lives, sacrifice their families for a little more recognition, a little more praise, right? A gold watch, a plaque on the wall. Third one's attractiveness. We go to some crazy attention-getting lengths to achieve this in the eyes of other people. Number four is acceptance. This is a big one, and in fact, I'm going to dive into this one big time next week because I think this one's doing a tremendous amount of damage to a lot of us, and this one has messed my life up in a lot of ways. I've spent a lot of years trying to figure out why I look to acceptance and acceptance of other people to give me something that only God can give me, and when you exist for the approval of another human being, right, in our culture, we call that codependency. The Bible would have just called that like idolatry. Number five is pleasure. And it's really possible for a human life to be completely oriented around self-gratification or a buzz. And generally, that happens because we've had some kind of deep pain in our life And so our entire life is revolved around avoiding that pain or numbing that pain. And so we find some kind of pleasure that actually doesn't remain pleasure for long, right? Because it becomes an idol and something you're looking to give you, something only God can give you, and you kind of become enslaved to that. So those are kind of five broad categories. I'm going to ask a series of questions. If you have a pen or a pencil, you can just put a check mark next to the one that applies, all right? So first question that I want to ask you guys is, which of these, kind of when you look at these five things, which of these do you find yourself thinking about the most? Like when you just think about a typical day and you're at work and you're daydreaming or you're laying in bed at night and you're just kind of spinning in your mind before you go to sleep, what are you thinking about? You thinking about money? You're thinking about success, how you need to move up the ladder? You're thinking about how you wish you were more attractive or ways you could become more attractive? Are you thinking about acceptance? Like you're just rehearsing constantly over and over in your head that thing that person said to you earlier in the day and you think now they don't like you or they said something about your sweater or whatever. Number two, which one of these do you fear losing the most? Like when you think about like losing this, it would crush you. Do you fear losing money? Do you fear losing attractiveness? Just put a check next to it. Number three, which of these idols most gives you a sense of identity? Right? Which one gives you the most sense of identity? In other words, which one of these do you kind of want to just be known for? And then the last question is, which one of these do you look to make you feel secure? Like when do you tend to feel the most safe? When you look through those five. Now, does that necessarily tell, do some of you mark all five of them? Like, because you're messed up if you did. I'm just kidding, you're not. You're probably very normal, right? Because all of these at different times and different seasons of life can become an idol for us. And here, listen, I hope you hear my heart on this. This isn't supposed to be guilt-inducing, right? The question is not, do you have idols, okay? The human heart is an idol factory. All right, so the question is not, do you have idols? The question we're trying to get to is, can we be self-aware enough to know which idols tend to be the most tempting? Which one of these things do we tend to look at the most to give us something that only God can give us? So this isn't about guilt. Ultimately, this is about trying to find freedom and trying to be a little more self-aware. Let me give you two more questions that you can ask yourself that sometimes help you discover out of those five things which one could possibly be an idol for you. The first question is, am I willing to sin to get it? And the second question is, am I willing to sin if I think I'm gonna lose it? And again, part of the big problem when you look over this list and you could, anything that can become an idol, part of the problem is these are good things, right? They're not bad things, right? I mean, money is not bad. Success is not bad. Attractiveness isn't bad. Acceptance, it's not bad. Pleasure, it's not bad. These aren't bad things. They're not inherently evil things. They're good things. The problem and where our life gets sideways real quick is when we put these good things in the wrong place and we establish this expectation that they're somehow going to give us something that only God can give us. Jesus addresses this, right? Luke chapter 14. It used to be a very, very confusing verse for me. Jesus says this, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and his children, his brothers and his sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. He says, if you can't hate your sister, you can't be my disciple. Some of you kids in here are like, well, I'm a better Christ follower than I thought that I actually was. But is Jesus like literally saying that you should hate your family? I mean, that I used to read that. I'm like, I must not understand what's happening there because that does not seem consistent with the person of Jesus to me. This is a man who loved people deeply, all people. And so how can this be? Like, what am I missing here? And I think what I was missing is what Jesus is saying here is not that you should literally hate your family. What Jesus essentially is saying here is that be very careful in life that you don't take a good thing and allow that good thing to become an ultimate thing. Because when the good thing becomes an ultimate thing, it becomes an idol thing, which then becomes a destructive thing. So it's real important that we allow good things to just stay good things and not allow those things to become ultimate things. This is helpful for me because now what I realize is my greatest temptation in life is to not chase after what is ridiculously evil. My greatest temptation in life is going to chase after what's deceptively good. Right? That's where I have to be careful. And that's probably where most of you have to be careful. Our temptation is not to do something that's going to land us on the front page of the paper tomorrow. Right? Our greatest temptation is to take these good things in life and allow these good things to become ultimate things, that become idol things, that then become destructive things. That's the temptation. And one of the things that we're going to discover over the next couple weeks is that the majority of idols that we have in our culture today are performance-based idols. Now, the problem with performance-based idols is they always make you think you have to do more. And so a lot of us are in this rat race. Most of us have this compulsive need to do more, to go faster, even when there's no reason to even be in a rush. That's part of the culture we live in, right? Don't you feel that? Don't you feel like there's just this sense of everybody's kind of weary, everybody's kind of tired, everybody's kind of burned out because we're trying to do more and more and more? That's what performance-based idols do, and that's the kind of culture those idols will set up. This is interesting. I read this week. In the 1960s, a group of futurists gave a report to Congress, and the report was all about technology and how technology was going to impact us in the future. And the futurists told Congress that by 1985, get this, by 1985, due to the advances in technology and efficiency, people would work 27 weeks out of the year, and the rest of the year they would have off. Wow. They missed that one, didn't they? Right. They predicted that the biggest problem in our entire society, thanks to technology, would be that we would have too much spare time. But it didn't turn out that way, did it? Just ask yourself, like, how long can you go without checking your phone? I won't ask for a show of hands because it would crush my ego, but I'm betting a lot of you have had to check it in the past 20 minutes, right? How long can you go without picking that phone up? How long can you go without checking an email? How long can you go without jumping on Snapchat or Instagram or something else that's going to remind you of how you're behind and you need to catch up? How often do you find yourself getting restless or impatient when you're standing in line or you're waiting in traffic? How often do you tell your kids to hurry up, even when there's no reason to hurry up? I'll never forget this. Is a couple years ago. I was trying to get my son upstairs, and we're walking up the steps, and he's just piddling, right? He's just taking his sweet time going up the steps, and I remember looking back at him and saying, "Brewer, come on, buddy, hurry up." And I turn around and I jump up a few more steps and I look back and he's still piddling. And I'm like, "Brewer, I'm serious. Come on, buddy, let's go. Hurry up." And he just looked up to me and he said, "Why?" Like, "Just shut up. Come on, hurry up. Let's go." Don't ask me why. Like, and it was a great question because I remember thinking, yeah, why? Why are we hurrying up the steps? Like, is the house on fire, or are we trying to go up the rescue? No, we're just going up the steps, and I feel this need that we should be going faster than we are. And I feel like as a society, we just keep telling each other, hurry up, hurry up. And somebody should just stop and say, why? Like, what are we chasing after? What do we think the end result of all this is going to be? Right? Does hurrying up really save us time? Like, are you accruing seconds that you get to spend later on something else? No. It just reinforces this need or this thinking that there's not enough time. So it doesn't save you time. It doesn't make your life more joyful, does it? You ever had somebody tailgating you in traffic and look back and they just have a big smile on their face? No, it's not bringing us more joy at all. In fact, I've tried recently this practice, and I'm gonna challenge you to do this week. I've been trying to just really be fully present in moments, especially with my kids. But I've been trying to be just fully present and really just kind of like look into the eyes, like really look into the eyes of people that I get to meet And it might be just when I'm in the grocery store line and my groceries are going down the belt, just like really looking at the person. Or it might be somebody that, you know, I'm at work with. For you, it might be somebody that you run into in the lobby of church. Just start looking at people, like really look into their eyes. You know what I've been seeing? It's not life. It's not joy. It's not vibrancy. It's not love. When I look into the eyes of the average person these days, most of the time, what I see is a ghost town. What I see is exhaustion, depleted, lacking, and empty. And I think I know why. See, idolatry exhausts you because your idols don't have the ability to breathe life back into you. All they do is take and take and take. For years, I've been going to India. I'm usually there a couple weeks a year, and I've been able to be a part of helping start some schools and some feeding centers over there, and I love the work over there, mostly in Kolkata, India, where Mother Teresa actually did the bulk of her ministry. And it's interesting, and I often take groups of people over there that want to kind of experience the culture. And so I'll take them to, there's a temple kind of right smack in the middle of Kolkata. And for me, it's honestly, it's just one of the saddest places that I ever visit because I just see so much despair there. And people come there to worship different gods that are set up around this temple. And so there'll be like a god of wealth, and you'll see this family who has nothing. I mean, literally, they have nothing. They have like one last goat that they have. And they bring that goat, and they'll sacrifice that goat. What little bit they have, they'll sacrifice to this god, hoping this god gives them a blessing of wealth. And there's this tree. It's a completely dead tree, not a leaf on this tree. It's a fertility tree is what they call it. There will be hundreds of women lined up waiting hours and hours and hours so they can give what last little bit of change they have at the base of that tree. And then they take this red ribbon and they tie it on one of the branches. And they're giving what little bit they have left because they have this dream. They want to be a mom. And they're hoping, giving what little bit of money they have at the base of that tree, that somehow this god of fertility is going to help them get pregnant. And I'm watching this stuff. I've watched it for years, and it's heartbreaking because you're just like, oh, man. They're giving and giving and giving, but that god that they think exists, that god's dead. That's a dead tree. That dead tree is not going to help them get pregnant. And it's hard to not be cynical, and I understand it's a completely different culture, but it's hard to not look at that and say, man, that just seems silly to me. But don't you think it's equally silly that you and I actually believe that maybe if we make a little more money next year, we'll actually be happier? Or if you and I could get that certain person to approve of us, that somehow then we would like have more security? Or if you and I could, you know, create the perfect household, the perfect little home, or get the perfect title, that somehow then we would have more value? Isn't that equally as silly? See, the reason so many of us are exhausted is because these idols don't have the capacity to breathe life back into us. Therefore, whenever you look to something else to give you something that only God can give you, you end up having to depend on your own abilities, right? And yourself to produce something that only God can produce. And there's nothing more exhausting than being the general manager of the universe. And in that moment, when you look to that thing to give you something that only God can give you, in that moment, you become enslaved to that something. You become a slave to your success. You become a slave to your own approval. You become a slave to money. And in that moment, you're not living the life that you were created to live. So I'm wondering if maybe there's another way. You see, I think a lot of us have been set free, but we don't know what it looks like to live free. And so if you're tired of striving and tired of performing and tired of pretending to be somebody you're not, what about being willing to try something new, to try something different? Will you guys do me a favor for just a second? Would you just close your eyes? I just want you to relax for just a second. We've been talking about busy and hurry and rushing, and let's just take a second to practice being fully present. So just close your eyes, just relax, get comfortable. Just breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. And with your eyes closed, let me read you a powerful, powerful invitation from Jesus for every single one of you. This is Matthew 11. Jesus says to you, come to me. That's what he says. He says, come to me. You know, it's almost as if Jesus knew that you and I would be chasing after all kinds of things to fill our inner emptiness. It's almost like he knew some of you were chasing after the money or chasing after the title or chasing after the approval, chasing after that perfect image. And he says, whoa, 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 time out. Hey, come to me. Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened. And you don't have to raise your hand, but I wonder how many of you are weary and burdened. How many of you are tired and stressed out and worn out and burned out? Jesus says, come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. He says, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Okay, you guys can open your eyes. What you think about that? He says, you can find rest for your soul. Do you know why that's important? You have to understand this. Listen, the exhaustion, the weariness, the burden, the burnout that you feel right now, it cannot be healed by a 2-hour Sunday afternoon nap. That's not going to take care of it. The exhaustion, the weariness that you feel cannot be taken care of with a 2-week vacation. See, you're exhausted at the soul level. You're exhausted at a place that only Jesus himself can heal. And that's why he says, come to me. Come to me. All of you who are weary and burdened and stressed out and burned out and frantic and chasing after all these performance-driven gods, come to me. Not because I want to give you more to do. Not because I have a job for you. I want you to do this or that or jump through this hoop. He says, come to me because I can give you rest for your soul. That's what this series is about. That's what these next couple weeks are all about, trying to help you find rest for your soul, trying to help you discover what it looks like to live truly free. So I hope you'll join us for it. Let me pray for you guys. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this day. We thank you so much, God, for who you are, for what you're doing in our lives. God, for those of us that are tired and weary and burned out and stressed out and frantic, for those of us who have been kind of in this cycle of chasing after things that cannot give us what you can give us. I pray that these next couple weeks will be a bit of a wake-up call. I pray, God, that we can be self-aware enough to realize that maybe there's some things on the inside in our soul, in the deep levels of our being, that we need to evaluate and that we need to work on. We thank you for the invitation to come to you, because in coming to you, we truly can find rest for our souls, and we can find a way to live this life that you've called us to live. For it's in your name that we pray. Amen. Hey, real quick before you go, if you're looking for different ways to take your next step spiritually speaking, we have a super easy way for you to do that. Just text the word Northridge to 313131, and we'll get you some next steps. Also want to remind you, there's a prayer team down front for any of you who might need prayer for any reason at all. We hope that you guys have an amazing week, and we'll see you next weekend, okay? God bless.